All right, well, welcome back. It's a pleasure to introduce faculty colleague of mine, Christos Levitskikos, who is at Penn with the Department of Radiology, and he heads up the section of biomedical image analysis that most of you probably are well aware of. Christos is well known to the community for a number of significant contributions, many firsts in the field. And I'll rattle off some of the acronyms that you might be familiar with. So Ravens work for doing voxelwise analysis, well-known hammer technique for registration that's extremely popular within the field, and more recently the classic work for doing longitudinal analyses. And I'm not exactly sure what Christos was going to talk about today, because I know that he, like me, we were both making web talks. I think this week, but it sounds like he stuck to what's in the abstract, which is morphological appearance manifolds for computational anatomy groupwise registration morphological analysis.
Can you hear me? A little bit closer. All right. Thanks, Jim, very much for the introduction. And I'd like to thank again the organizer for this really great meeting. So with as hard as it is to speak after John, I'm glad he gave a fantastic overview of VBM, because some of the ideas I will be discussing relate to his work on VBM, but some of the ideas we'll be discussing relate also to what you heard in the computational anatomy session, so I will kind of bridge between these two. So let me just very briefly remind you that the computational anatomy framework that was pioneered largely by Mike and his group and a number of other people later starts with a reference space where we have a template that we use sort of as a unit of anatomy. And we find a transformation that when we want to characterize the morphology of a new anatomy, a new person's brain, for example, we find this transformation that we typically like to have some nice properties, such as being a diffeomorphism, or sometimes you might have a space-occupying lesion, such as tumors, which violate this assumption. But most of the times we want it to be a diffeomorphism. And if it's done well enough, it can basically capture the morphological characteristics of our brain that we're measuring with respect to the unit, which is a template. So if we have a logal expansion, that means we have more, a larger volume there. If we have contraction, we have perhaps atrophy. And that works pretty well for subcortical structures, for things like the corpus callosum. This is a slide that I'm emotionally attached to because I was a postdoc back in 1994-5. I was following some of the first papers of Mike's, actually, and trying to work the corpus callosum, a template of the corpus callosum, through an MRI of the corpus callosum. And you get a very nice warping, of course, and the transformation captures everything you want to know about this shape. And I was looking at differences between men and women and older and younger people and things like that. But when you try to apply these things to the cortex, you stumble across many obstacles. And, you know, basically you might have a template that looks like this and a subject that looks like this, and then the warping becomes very difficult. If anything, it's very difficult to define a correspondence consistently across individuals. Even if you were to decide to pull this guy down and map it here and then flow everything else accordingly, it's not going to happen consistently across objects because of the variability. Sometimes you might get things like that using a multi-scale image matching with freeform deformations thing, which although you can constrain it to be a diffeomorphism by maintaining positivity of the Jacobian, it has done a very bad thing. Maybe a very bad thing. Most importantly, sometimes or many times, the transformation itself might not be, or alone, might not be the best way to represent the difference between two shapes. This is a template and this is a shape that we want to measure, and they differ in a very simple way, pretty much like the previous little shapes. You can find a diffeomorphism from A to B that looks like this. It applies a global scaling, basically, which is almost an identity. In this case, they are very similar in size. And you can start pulling this thing down to create an indentation. And this is all fine. And you can do it diffeomorphically, and you will create a wave of compressions basically through the template that will smear out this information throughout the whole shape. So you will have a Jacobian that will show you some compression that will be variable throughout the region, or depending on what regularizer you use. Well, here's an alternative way of looking at the difference between the two shapes. Just apply a small identity transformation, I mean a small scaling, and measure the residual, the difference between what remains after the transformation and our shape. Now, this highlights very vividly the differences between the two shapes, which is this indentation. So in this particular case, and in many cases in real data, a reasonable, quote-unquote, and I'll talk about what is reasonable alignment, followed by or in conjunction with the residual, is actually perhaps the best way of describing morphological characteristics. So my talk will be about basically how to combine the transformation with the residual. And some of our earlier work, we've been using the Rayleigh's maps that Jim referred to, or tissue-preserving shape transformations that we introduced back in the mid-90s. We've been using that for a while now. And I believe this is completely equivalent to what John is calling the modulated VBM. They both create a density map, which is the Jacobian determinant times a template plus a residual that is necessary to complete what the diffeomorphism doesn't capture. You can view this in a more simplistic way, which is how we created the Ravens. You can go from the shape to the template, and if you have a small shape that you stretch, its density goes down because you have spread out the tissue in a larger area, and vice versa. So if you have four boxes that compress to one, this density goes up to four. But it turns out that this is basically the Jacobian determinant times a template plus a residual. And I use I here, the residuals are not just a single image, in order to get rid of, exactly as in VBM, to get rid of an arbitrary scaling of the images and inhomogeneities and other things, we first segment the images into a number of tissues, say gray matter, white matter, and CSF, so we have now indicator functions. It's one or zero depending on if you have a specific tissue. So these residuals actually are residuals of indicator functions. So we've used this methodology for a while, which was initially kind of intuitively adopted by us because we didn't want to throw out the residual because, as I said earlier, the transformation didn't seem to capture all we wanted to capture. We used it in a number of studies. This is from some of our earlier studies in aging where we studied the longitudinal progression of atrophy by looking at how, this is from the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging, where we found the areas in the brain which show significant longitudinal atrophy, which is decrease of these Ravens maps. This is a publication from last year from the ADNI data sets where we looked at differences between Alzheimer's disease patients, normal controls, and MCI. And if you can't read this, these T values are about 11 or plus. So it's very, very significant differences between these groups that actually allowed us to identify individual scans with almost 100% accuracy. You can also do individual person analysis. This shows you a little movie of the progression of atrophy in a person over a 10-year period, who ultimately developed Alzheimer's disease. His Ravens maps or tissue densities kept going down. And we also have a number of studies in schizophrenia where things are a little more complex. There's this very complex spatial patterns of reduction of gray matter, which identifies people that have schizophrenia and relates to a number of structures such as the hippocampus, the insula, etc. So let's go back to our formulation. So we want to have a lossless representation of anatomy, and by lossless I mean that we always need to have a residual that completes what the transformation doesn't capture. And the Ravens maps or tissue density maps are one way of doing that. Let's call the concatenation of aids and the residuals, or sometimes the log Jacobian determinant and the residual, if we're interested only in volumetric changes, as M, and this now becomes our representation. And we make sure that what this says is basically that the template, you have a template, you need to add a residual and apply a transformation H in order to be able to capture exactly your subject S. Now, this is from a real example. We've been using HAMR, the formal registration method that has been built in our laboratory by Ding Yang Shen and myself several years back, which, like many other algorithms, achieves a high degree of conformality of brains to a single template. This is a template, and this is the average of 150 brains of older individuals, ages 55 to almost 90 that has been worked to this template. And you see a very clear average like the ones that Jones showed or Sarang the other day. But even with these registration algorithms, there's a lot of residual in the cortex if you look at individuals. So in addition to using real data, we have created a little database of shapes that we can control better. We know exactly how we created them. We know exactly how they differ from each other. So we use them as a ground truth, so to speak, to simulate the wild variations of the cortical folds. So this has samples from a family of shapes that, as you see, some sauci have two folds, some of them have one. And these are the same. These are samples from the same family, except that we have introduced thinning in this area here, in all of these shapes. And the question is, if you have a good morphological descriptor or morphological analysis algorithm, can you detect exactly where the atrophy is or what the difference between these two groups is? We will use the standard formulation, and I'm glad John talked about it, the voxel-based morphometry all the voxelized methods, basically, that apply a local smoothing, and they perform voxel-by-voxel statistical tests to compare two populations. And in general, we assume that the registration algorithm you use, there's a number of registration algorithms, but in general, they're based on some term that matches images or features extracted from images. And there's a regularizer, which basically tries to achieve smooth fields. Sometimes the regularizer might be a shape prior if you're using an active shape model. But basically, you always have this lambda here, one way or another, which controls the amount of smoothness that your transformation will have. If lambda is small, you have a very aggressive deformation that leaves very little residual. If lambda is large, you have a smooth transformation that leaves a lot of residual. So let's go back to this simulated shapes and see if we apply a deformation based method to detect the atrophy. What I show here on the left, sigma, to remind you, is the smoothing that we applied before the voxel-based analysis, and lambda is the regularization parameter in these plots. So what this shows is the p-value of our ability to detect the atrophy in the simulated atrophy in these shapes. What you see here for different lambdas, for the smallest lambda, which is the most aggressive transformation, the log Jacobian determinant basically picks up a fair amount of this atrophy. So we have a p-value of 10 to the minus 4 or something like that. It's the minimum. The average is a little less impressive, but basically, if we apply these deformations, we see a statistically significant difference between the Jacobians of the shapes that had the atrophy and the Jacobians of the shapes that did not have the atrophy. As we start making the deformation smoother and smoother, we lose this effect, which is what we expect, because we have less and less conformality. So we're happy that our Jacobian basically captures these deformations, this atrophy. But if you look at the residual, of course, the residual also depends on the amount of regularization you have, but you achieve much better detection of the atrophy. So in this particular case, you have a few orders of magnitude lower p-values just by looking at the residual and ignoring the transformation itself. So this was a bit surprising to me, but basically that kind of motivates even further that we really need to consider this transformation together with the residual. Now, and that's what we do by concatenating these two. Now, we introduce a number of problems. Or a major problem, which is that we have a non-unique representation. I can represent the brain as an aggressive deformation of a template and almost very little residual, or I can represent it with a smooth deformation, maybe a translation, and a lot of residual. Which of them should I choose? Well, non-uniqueness is a big problem, and we're going to deal with this in a second. The second problem, which is actually not only present in our formulation, but in the classical formulation of computational anatomy, is that as you choose your template, you can actually get different results. And of course, there's a lot of nice work, and Sarang gave a nice talk about finding average templates, and Jim and others have done work on finding geodesic averages. But basically, even if you have a group average, you still have a single template. And that's a bit problematic, because if I change the way that I define my average template, I will find different results. And the biggest problem is that even if you have a universally agreed template procedure. This guy that happens, just by chance, to be close to the group average will be represented by almost an identity transformation, so nothing and zero residual. This guy, that is also a perfectly valid brain, is far away. And will have, so the template will have both difficulty going there and would leave a lot of residual. So kind of the gist of the method I will be describing in a second is that you'll try to move this template around depending on which subject you're looking at. And essentially, every person will have an optimal template and an optimal lambda regularization parameter in a way that will try to make these brains treat it in the same way, if you want, relative to the template. So let's go back to the non-uniqueness of the problem, where up to a couple of years ago, we used to call these equivalence classes. Basically, an equivalence class that corresponds to a specific subject is all the representations M for which this equation holds, which means that all the transformations and residuals that reconstruct that particular brain. There are infinitely many of them, as I said before, so they form an equivalence class. We have many subjects in our study, so we have many of these equivalence classes. In practice, we cannot sample all possible transformations that we can apply to the template, so we have a number of parameters theta that control these transformations. These can be parameters of our registration algorithm. Lambda is one of the most important parameters, how much smoothness we're going to have. Changing the template is another parameter. So at that point, about 2 years ago, we realized, to our embarrassment actually, that there was a completely analogous work that was taking place in computer vision. People call this image appearance manifolds. And they're the same thing. They're equivalence classes that you build by viewing the same object from different perspectives or with different lighting conditions. And if your goal is to be able to recognize this cube, you'd better learn these variations, because otherwise you'll think it's a different object. So that's what people try to do, is they try to build these manifolds, which they call appearance, image appearance manifolds, and they try to find the position of the manifold that best represents a given observation. Other people have been looking at expression, facial expression manifolds. The same person appears different if he or she smiles or is angry or is sad. So if you want to recognize this person, you'd better learn these variations and create a manifold that represents this person under different conditions, not under a single condition. So we started calling them morphological appearance manifolds to be in line with that work. These manifolds, unfortunately, are very ugly. When you have edges moving in an image, actually, you don't even have this. This in the continuum, they are nowhere differentiable, and Donoff and others have shown that. And I'm trying to create a little schematic to show you why they are nowhere differentiable, or they are non-differentiable in a large number of points. If you have a point moving through the image, and it's you record the three coordinates, you basically move from this point to that point, and then suddenly to this point, and then suddenly to another direction. So in all of these corner points here, you have non-differentiability. So every time an object moves through the image, you, as new voxels light up, you kind of move in a new direction, new dimension. So this is a jerky local motion that kind of modulates a broader nonlinear structure of a manifold, and this is what we want to capture. So luckily, there's some nice work by Waking in his thesis, supervised in part by Donoho, who showed that if you actually smooth these images, you actually create differentiable manifolds. And in addition to that, we use another technique which basically does a local approximation of the manifolds by local PCA to capture, assuming that locally the manifold can be represented linearly. And then as you move on the manifold, you update your approximations. So now let's see how we can get a unique morphological descriptor out of all these infinitely many ones that we have. You see this as a number of manifolds that correspond to our normal controls, and these are a number of manifolds that correspond to our patients. This guy happens to look like the template, so he's represented by the identity transformation. This guy happens to look different from the template, so he's represented by a large residual and a transformation that has a lot of deformation, if you want. And basically, this introduces a lot of variance in our data that confounds our ability to detect the group differences. The goal here is to allow these points to slide along the manifolds and find the configuration which minimizes the variance or the sum of square distances, the pairwise square distances, which is equivalent to minimizing this quantity here, the variance of these distances. So we want to bring them as close as possible, but constrain them to be on their manifolds, because we don't want to change the fact that this person's brain is given and it doesn't change. So every time I move along this manifold, I have a different representation of the same brain. And I try to find the one that lines them up best so that I remove this confounding variation that is related not to biology, but to my modeling assumptions and regularization parameters and templates that I have chosen, etc. And I want to amplify this, which is what I really wanted to measure, which is biological difference between the two groups. So what this achieves at the same time is a unique morphological descriptor, because we find a solution, and a group-wise registration, because every time you move along your manifold, you change the transformation, and therefore you change the registration of the template. At the same time, because if you have included multiple templates in building the manifold, you actually find the optimal template for every individual. So this is an ugly problem, as you can probably imagine. So the first thing we did is to do a perform a linear approximation by using PCA. These are known formulas, and you can find the optimal projection coefficients very easily. We fit hyperplanes to each person's appearance manifold, and then we slide along these hyperplanes to find the solution. Going back to that example with the simulated shapes, again, the Jacobians gave us a reasonably good detection, but not the best we can do. This is the Raven's maps for different lambdas and sigmas, and this is the optimal solution that we found. So the p-value reaches 10 to the minus 10, which is about 5 orders of magnitude better than the Jacobian itself, and it's also a unique solution. It doesn't depend on lambda, and it doesn't depend on the template at this point. So again, from this, you see that the combination of the transformation and the residual achieves much more than we can achieve by the transformation only. Some examples with real brain images where we want to know exactly what we're looking for. So we have a simulator of atrophy, about 30 brains, half of them we introduce atrophy in this particular region around the superior temporal gyrus. And the question is, can you solve this optimization problem and detect this atrophy? Log Jacobian determinant does pretty well, particularly for very little regularization. So 10 to the minus 5 and a half into the minus 5, so it gives a very significant difference in the superior temporal gyrus, which is where we introduce the atrophy. The combined optimal representation reaches up to 10 to the minus 10. So even now and this was actually a fairly easy problem for the Jacobian, because the superior temporal gyrus is right next to the insula, which basically makes the registration a bit easier. So, but even in this case, although we detected here, we detected better with the combined representation. Now, as an aside, you can use the same exact, one of our interests has been longitudinal analysis. So, because we're involved in a number of longitudinal brain imaging studies, and we have seen that, as I'm sure all of you that have done longitudinal studies have seen, is that if you perform this voxel-based analysis, and you measure a person over time, you have a very jerky, you can find voxels, so regions will have a very jerky curve. Things go up and down and up and down, and that doesn't make sense. Part of it is scanner problems and distortions and things like that. Part of it is the way our algorithms see the data. If the person is positioned differently in the scanner, your registration might give you a different local minimum, etc. So we want to eliminate this jerky motion because there's not this bottleness in the data. So we use the same framework. This is now time point 1, time point 2, time point L. And we have a number of appearance manifolds, and then we slide along this manifold to minimize the distance among them. This is a much easier problem because this is the same person over time, so these manifolds are very close to each other. They're separated by a little bit, which presumably is what has changed from time 1 to time 2, which is what you're interested in measuring. So these are some examples, which the results were actually quite dramatic. I believe these are Raven's maps in the hippocampus. We simulated atrophy in the hippocampus in the posterior cingulate, which are two regions that we're interested in studying Alzheimer's disease. And if you do the 3D density or Raven's maps, basically you get something that looks like this. Now, these are voxel-based measurements, so they have a lot of noise. If you smooth them more, you will smooth things out, but then you will lose your ability to detect longitudinal atrophy as well. If you apply the optimization, not only we reduce this noise, but we see a very consistent decrease atrophy, if you want, which is what we simulated there. Same thing for the posterior cingulate, which was even more dramatic variation. We used 3D data and a much better estimate of the longitudinal atrophy if you use this optimized approach. All right, so we approximated this morphological appearance manifolds by hyperplanes, and you know, which is okay, but these are not these don't look like hyperplanes. And I wanted to show you what they look like here. They're highly nonlinear manifolds. This is one person's manifold projected. We cannot draw in a high-dimensional space, so we found the three principal components that best describe the variation of this manifold, and we enclosed it in this hypercube in this case. So we vary the lambda, and we show basically how the projection looks like. So you see these are convoluted manifolds, and if you rotate them, you get a better feel of what they look like. So linear approximations, a linear approximation will basically say that I embed this into a larger space at best, or I do another linear approximation of it, and I allow myself to move outside the manifold, which is not a very good idea. So we decided to go back and do locally linear approximations of this manifold. So as these points slide along the manifold, you locally approximate it linearly, you solve the problem that I described earlier using PCA, and then you project on the manifold again, and then you do a new approximation, and you keep going, and if you let it run for a couple of days, you get a result. We made the problem a bit difficult. We shifted these shapes around randomly to make it a bit more difficult. And this shows you just an example of the optimal solution. These are three of these manifolds, three different people, or actually three different shapes, simulated shapes. The optimal solution, you can ignore the green and the red. These are two variations of the same theme. Basically, the optimal solution for one guy is about a quarter along the manifold. For the other guy is, you know, about a fifth along the manifold. For the other guy, I don't know exactly where it is, but basically it shows you that it tries to find the optimal solution that minimizes the group difference, so to speak, measured by the variance. These are some of the results. For these more difficult cases, the Jacobian failed completely. The Raven's map for small lambda failed. For some lambda, we got good results, but this is the optimized result for using L1 norm and L2 norm. And I'll get back to the L1 norm in a second, following upon Sarang's resounding thesis that L1 is a better norm, right? And I fully agree with that. So, but before that, I want to give you this is still a work in progress. We've been playing with the Raven's maps for years, but with this representation, we're still trying to figure out how to best do things. And a couple of the findings that were a bit surprising. The nonlinear approximation didn't work better than the linear. So these are nonlinear manifolds, but it turns out that if you let your point move outside the manifold, you actually don't lose much. And I'm trying to figure out why, but one of my guesses is that because of these manifolds are so convoluted, try to slide n points along this manifold simultaneously and find an optimal solution, you basically get stuck in a local minimum. That could be very bad. And therefore, you're better off letting it freely move in this larger space and find the solution. The second reason is that this point, although it doesn't live on the manifold, it actually is a smooth version of all these guys. And if you look at these solutions here, they are smeared out versions of the shapes. And this smearing basically smooths the data, and it turns out that it helps removing some of the noise, exactly for the same reason why VBM methods like to smooth the data before applying statistical tests, because you remove a bit of the noise. So that's one of the reasons. My postdoc is convinced that L1 norm is better than L2. I'm a little less convinced, but definitely I think most people that have been involved in imaging, in image analysis and vision, agree that L1 norm-based distances are better in handling outliers. The problem is that the non-differentiability makes it even more difficult for us to solve these problems, but it turns out that you can rewrite, I guess I'll skip through most of this, but basically what I want to show is you can rewrite this optimization problem. Apologies, this has changed from M to Q, but this is the same thing. This is a combined representation using the transformation of the residual. And you can write the difference, if you have a point sitting on this manifold and a point sitting on the jth manifold, you can write the difference between these two as this. You can create a bigger matrix, and you can rearrange things a little bit where Ci is the local PCA basis of the ith manifold and Cj is the jth manifold. And to make the long story short, you can basically come up with something that looks like this. This is an almost linear, it's not exactly linear because you have your L1 norm. And you're trying to solve for the projection coefficients alpha, which will determine our position on the manifold. And this, there are efficient ways of solving convex programming methods that solve these things if you have enough memory in your computer. Unfortunately, these are huge matrices, and I welcome opinions of people that know optimization better than I do, but we have run into memory problems. So I will move to the very last part of my talk, which is just a few more slides. And I want to relate what I was saying now to what I will, the couple of slides that I will show you now seem disconnected from the rest of my talk, but actually I will show you how they're related in the end. So another line of work that my group has pursued quite a bit in the past several years is high-dimensional pattern classification methods. That look at these spatial patterns of atrophy or functional activity, if you want, in fMRI, and try to classify individual scans as belonging to one class or another. This is important for diagnostic purposes, because even if you have significant group differences between Alzheimer's patients and normal controls, you have a lot of overlap between populations. So when you're giving an individual scan and you try to classify as class A or class B, then you really, the group difference doesn't help you. You have to come with very sensitive and specific markers for an individual. So we're using these classification methods, and we have to deal with a well-known curse of dimensionality. You have a very huge dimensionality. You can, in principle, select every voxel as your variable, as your feature. So to relieve this problem, people have been looking at sparse image representations, and so we... So you try to find a very low dimensional approximation of an image or a Raven's map or a displacement field that is based on a small number of variables or expansion coefficients, if you want, that capture what you want to capture about this spatial pattern. So EVEX is a matrix that has our data, which can be Jacobian maps, it can be Raven's maps, it can be something else. You try to expand it into a basis, a number of basis functions that are captured by the columns of F and G of the coefficients. So this is a classic linear expansion. In non-negative matrix factorization, which we have found very helpful, you impose additional constraints, positivity constraints. You want your basis to be positive, and you want your coefficients, your expansion coefficient, to be positive. It turns out that it can be shown both mathematically and experimentally that this leads to sparse solutions. And in fact, not only sparse solutions, also parts-based representations. So for the purposes of what we're interested in, we will hope to come up with a number of brain regions that are the most informative in terms of the differences between, say, Alzheimer's patients and normal controls. So... and then we've done this for, this is some results from the ADNI study again. We, to our pleasant surprise, this approach came out with a number of bases that were placed exactly where we would like to see them. And we know biologically that, of course, the hippocampi are affected in Alzheimer's disease, the cingulate is affected, a number of temporal lobe regions are affected. So that's where these optimal bases were placed. So this is nice, but what happens is the reason why the problem with these high-dimensional classification schemes is that they don't generalize very well. If you find a training set, you say, I have my Alzheimer's and normals, I train my support vector machine, and I come up with something that looks good. When you try to apply it on a testing sample, it doesn't work as well. And that's because you have too many features, and you might have chosen the wrong features, the features that don't generalize well. So that's where, and this is my last slide, we're trying to link this work with what I was describing earlier. If you think of these directions as the morphological appearance manifolds of NPL people in the study, and this, of course, is multiple directions, you put them all into a number of directions W that you call bad directions. Obviously, if you're trying to select a feature that has a significant projection of this direction, it means that from one person to another, it will vary a lot depending on what regularization it's used, depending on what template I have chosen, or any other confounding variable. in my modeling. So what you do is you say, I want to solve the non-negative magic factorization problem again and find the best features in my sparse representation, but I would like to be orthogonal to W, which is the set of directions that I found to be bad, or directions that go along this morphological appearance manifold. So we hope, and I don't have any results to show you, but the preliminary results show fairly good, that this will actually make give us the opportunity to extract stable and generalizable features that don't depend on these modeling assumptions and variables as much as they would otherwise do. All right, so in conclusion, what I have maintained is that the conventional computational anatomy framework can be insufficient whenever you have wild variations of anatomy, such as in the cortex. And if we augment it by residual information, that is what cannot be captured by the theomorphism, we can have a lossless representation, which potentially can be much more sensitive and specific of disease. Well, by doing that, we introduce a non-uniqueness, which has to do with the fact that we now can represent the same person in infinitely many ways by different transformations and residuals, but we have solved it using one possible way. I'm sure there are many other and better ways of doing that. We've solved this by finding a minimum, by solving a minimum variance problem that determines a single solution for the entire group. So it's at the same time a series of groupwise registration and optimal morphological representation, and we are using this to obtain robust features for classification. And that's pretty much the end of my talk. I would like to thank four people that have contributed to this work. Two of them are in this picture, two of them are not, and everybody else in my group that have somehow contributed to the work.
Questions for Christos?
Yeah.
Well, it was an excellent presentation. I have my only question, and I thought I understood it once when we talked earlier, is why don't these manifolds intersect?
Why do they don't intersect? Because if they intersected, they would be the same person. By definition, they don't intersect. Because it means that you can, as you move along the manifold, you're reconstructing the same anatomy, the same brain. If they intersect at some point, they're the same person's manifold. Because this point of intersection cannot be two different brains among this, unless these brains are identical. So if they intersected, that would mean that the two brains are identical.
Is it important? Sorry,
sorry.
Following. Is it important that they don't intersect?
Well, by definition, they don't intersect.
But I mean, is there anything about the numerics that I mean, what's the problem that if they do happen to intersect? I mean,
there wouldn't be any problem. But they don't, like,
well,
I said.
Well, technically, be the same manifold. That's what you're saying.
It would be very easy to find. Then it would be very easy to actually test that your solution is correct, because it has to find the zero distance.
I mean, the fact that you can register brains very close to each other with very small residues means that you're getting very close to each other. The places where, I mean, if you look, show your hammer result, I mean, all of the brains, you've got very little residue left, so they're coming very, very close to each other.
They don't. If they're different brains, they don't, because you have, if they come close to each other, if you register them very well, say with LDBMM, you will have maybe zero residual, but the deformation will be different. So for them to come close, it has to be both the residual has to be the same and the transformation. So they have to be the same brain.
Okay. No, thanks.
Yes.
So when we compared in more general applications, non-negative matrix factorization with ICA, we found that ICA seems to generally work a lot better. Have you compared that in this scenario of generating basic functions for feature selection?
With feature selection using ICA or using other methods?
Yeah.
Not with ICA specifically. We haven't used ICA in this context. No, it could be, but one of the reasons why we picked, and we've been using other ways for feature selection in the past, which are more machine learning, ad hoc methods of, you know, reverse feature elimination, things like that. But NMF, because it leads to parts-based representation of images, it's easier to interpret. That's one of the problems with ICA and definitely with PCA and other methods, that they lead, they give diffuse bases that it's very difficult for you to interpret. Where these bases tend to be localized and they focus on a specific part of the anatomy. So, but we haven't compared the number of different methods.
It seems likely that because the restriction, for example, on text overlap in ASCII is you don't have the same restriction that you actually have more flexibility to find relevant patterns. So, for example, you might get two subgroups that weren't discriminating on the basis of one part of the brain, but then another discriminant across the subjects, which uses another part but also potentially overlapping parts, and you would potentially want to find those as they are and not artificially force them to be non-overlapping.
Yes. Now, it could be. There's no reason that they would be. They should be non-overlapping. But the more overlap you introduce, the more variables, the more bases you would need to describe your image, which means that the more difficult would be then for your machine learning tool to generalize well, unless you have thousands of brains. But if you have a situation where you have 100 brains, you really want to sparsify your bases. But yeah, it could be that, and I think basically my experience with this, all these machine learning methods is that in some case one works better than the other one and vice versa. So it could be, we haven't done an extensive study. There was a question to ask? Oh.
Well, so one question, Christos. You know, when you showed the minimum variance solution and all the particular configuration all lined up vertically on those manifolds, how different is that group average from, because you are ultimately in the end, like you said, performing group wise registration.
Mm-hmm.
So how different is that result if you were to average those configurations for say what SAR
might
generate? And, good. Is it simply the residual term that gets factored in? And
I don't know if, let me go back to this slide, because I want you to say a few words. I'm glad you asked this question. I forgot to say this few words.
I'm doing my best here.
we didn't talk before in Philly, right? It's a spontaneous question. All right, so it turns out that if you average these optimal representations, they're going to be fuzzy. They're not going to look like a crisp brain. Because the optimal transformation in template, and the optimal smoothness in template, is not necessarily the one that gives you the most aggressive deformation. In fact, we have found, which we kind of expected, that the best is to have a reasonably good registration and then leave the rest to the residual. But the reasonably good registration means to align the rough location of the gyrations of the cortex. But it doesn't do a very aggressive matching. Which effectively means that if you take the average brain, it's going to look much fuzzier. But it allows you to detect differences better, at least in our experiments. Another thing I want you to mention is that... maybe I won't ask the question. The break would be better.
Okay, well, let's join me. Thank you for speaking.